We'll call the meetings to order. We'll call the Senate committee, and then Nancy will then call the House committee, and then we'll go from there. All right, everybody? Ready to start the recording when you are, Dan.
Recording is live.
Good morning, everyone. This is the May and Economic Revenue Forecast. I'm Mark Hass, along with my fellow Revenue Committee members in the House and Senate. First order of business, I suppose, is to organize our committees and call them to order. And so let me first gavel in and call the Senate Finance and Revenue Interim Committee to order. And Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Senator Hass. Hi, everyone. Yes, at this time, I'm calling to order the House Interim Committee on Revenue.
Thank you. A couple of housekeeping issues here, revenuers. If you can, unmute when you're not talking. That'll cut down on some extraneous noise. You might also want to turn off your video when you're not speaking. You'll see a chat box on your screen. It's when you move your cursor over three, a little message box will come up. And get in that chat box if you have a question. And Representative Nathanson or myself will call on you as we go through this. We tried, because of the historic nature of this particular revenue forecast, to conduct this forecast down at the state capitol, where some of us could be present. But alas, the health and safety concerns were just too great. And so we are all remote, including our two state economists. I guess this is historic, too. Mark McMullen is at his home, and Josh Lerner will be joining him from over in Bend. And so we're all remote. I want to say hello to Rep. Mark Owens. I think this is his first one. And Rep. Lawrence Spence, I think this is probably your first one, too. And I want to say happy birthday to Representative Kenny Geyer. Kind of an auspicious day to celebrate your birthday, but welcome all fellow Revenue Committee members. This one, I predict, will be one to remember. Thank you for your patience and setting up remotely. Thank you to the legislative revenue staff and Dan and everybody for getting the bugs out of this for a practice session and making sure this will work. To everyone that may be watching, this presentation on the forecast should be loaded up on the OLIS website now. It's easily accessible, and you can download it or follow along with the presentation. So to Josh and Mark, I will turn it over to you.
Thank you, Chair Hass, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. For the record, this is Mark McMullen, Oregon State economist. Dan, you can go ahead and start sharing the slides now, if you can. So while this forecast certainly does represent a sea change relative to what we've presented to this committee in the past, I think it's important to mention off the bat that the nature of the forecast is really unchanged. And what I mean by that is this forecast really reflects what our office and our advisory group believe is the most probable outcome given the information that we have available. We know for sure that we're going to be off, and the forecast will be off by quite a bit, but it's really designed so that we believe it's just as likely that those errors will be on the high side as they are on the low side. That we're not trying to do a conservative estimate or anything on one side or the other. This is really our best guess of where we're going to land. But, you know, both errors on the upside and the downside are both really painful in a recessionary environment. If the forecast is too low, well, then policymakers are forced to do unnecessarily deep cuts, which are particularly costly because the less painful cuts, you know, tend to go first, and the deeper you go, the more damage is done. But there are also problems with a forecast that's on the high side. In particular, you know, if the truth comes out and there isn't as much money as was projected, well, then we have to continue to do rebalancing exercises over time. And the last three sessions, our office has really erred on the optimistic side, and we've delivered this news to policymakers very slowly over time, which can become more and more difficult as we get approach the end of a biennium. As we get closer and closer to the end of the biennium, most of the allocated money has already been spent. So that rebalancing exercise becomes much more difficult. The nightmare scenario happened in 2002 when due to OEA and our office continually over time, over quarters, reducing the forecast, the legislature had to call five special sessions to continue to rebalance those that budget. And eventually time ran out, and we had to borrow our way out of the hole. It took 10 full years to pay that off. So in one sense, the sudden stop in economic activity that we've seen does make the outlook a bit clearer. The consensus of economic forecasters have been delayed in terms of their acceptance of recessions in recent business cycles, you know, basically going through stages of grief, where at first analysts say, well, we're not in a recession yet, it's just a slowdown. And then when it becomes clear that there is a recession, we switch our argument to, oh, well, there's a recession, but it'll probably be a mild one. And then when it clearly becomes a deep recession, we change the story to, well, yes, the recession's deep, but we'll have a relatively healthy recovery. Finally, when the recovery stalls, it's been months and months of increasingly bad news that we've delivered to decision makers. So with this particular recession, it was unique in that it became clear overnight that not only were we in a recession, but that it was going to be a severe one. And so what we've done here is we've really, you know, sensitive to our past office errors, we're really doing our best to try to tear the Band-Aid off all at once, as it were, you know, to try to incorporate the full pain that we're going to see over the next couple of budget cycles so that policymakers can adjust to that target. So with that as an intro, if you mind switching to the first slide in the deck is about the health assumptions that we're going to use after the economic outlook slide here. Obviously the health assumptions are vital this time around, given that the economic forecast and the health forecast are very intricately connected. If the health situation turns south, the economic growth will as well. So while we're not trying to predict every single event and every single thing that happens on the health front, there are a couple of broad assumptions that we've made, which are on the next slide, please, Dan. And those are, first, that over this summer, our social distancing policies are going to be gradually lifted, that the shutdown will come to an end over the summer. The phase one that we're going through now, obviously just the first step. We have more than 40% of our population now is in phase one with some sort of reopening. Over 30% of our jobs are already in phase one. So this is just but this will progress further over the summer in our assumptions until most everything is open a couple months from down the road. And then the next big assumption is that once we get a year down the road, we get closer to an all clear insofar as some resolution to the health situation is available, whether it be a treatment, or a vaccine, or that the virus mutates into a more benign form, or whatever it may be. A year from now, we're pretty close to an all clear in terms of the health situation, and the recovery can really begin in earnest. Go to the next slide, Dan. I'll give the 30,000-foot view of really what us and our advisors have come down to in terms of the shape of this recovery and recession. How to read this chart, particularly for the two new members. I know we have we've put charts like this up several times before for the group. But for the new members, the way to read this is we start on the left-hand part of this chart at 0%. At that point is when the jobs are at their peak heading into various recessions. And then as we move forward into recessions, we lose jobs. And the percentage there in terms of what we're looking on the red current line is quite a bit right off the bat, you know, on the order of 20% overnight in this particular recession. But then as you go forward over time, when those lines return to the 0% line, that's when we've recovered all of the jobs that we lost during the downturn. We're not back to what our budget projections were before, given that we expected growth in the past, but nevertheless, we have recovered all that was lost at that point in time. So what jumps out here with this current recession is it certainly doesn't look like what we've become accustomed to in the past. In particular, you know, the sharpness of this decline is really unprecedented. Now, we do see things that look like this in the economic data from time to time with these big spikes. And typically, they're one of two things. They're either a natural disaster, like a hurricane in a region, or a major employer has a labor dispute and a strike. But, in terms of hurricanes and strikes, however, you know, while the pain can be swift, the recovery is just as swift. Once we enter the rebuilding phase, we bounce back pretty much all the way in those events. But unfortunately, we can't really expect that same sort of dynamic this time. Now, while once the economy opens up, we can certainly expect some snapback, but it's clear that things won't be the same, that sales levels aren't the same, and even if there were no public restrictions, it's going to take a while for some households to want to go to the next football game or take an airplane or the like. And so we don't get a complete rebound, but a significant one here this summer and fall. Over a third of the jobs we've lost come back as we open up the economy to growth. But then we hit a soft patch in terms of our outlook. You see here that the recovery kind of flattens out. We've been referring to this shape as sort of like a square root symbol. It's not really, but that's about as close as we can come to it, largely because we have this big drop followed by a period of flattening. There's a lot going on during this period of slower growth that's expected. One of them is just the regular dynamics of a recession. As you see in past recessions, particularly the deep ones, the last two, 2001 and 2007, it takes a year or more before, the full pain is realized. We get a income shock right away, and then that trickles through the economy downstream to different suppliers and different industries, where we start seeing producers of goods and professional and business services, which in this recession haven't been hit too hard yet. They really start to feel the pain down the line. So we're going to start having a little bit of that dynamic as well this time. But then there are, of course, more things layered on with this particular recession. One is, of course, is the uncertainty with the health situation and the to what extent are households and firms going to be willing to dive back in and do what they were doing before the recession. And the other one to mention would be fiscal policy. Insofar as most of the government federal fiscal support programs are going away here after this summer, and which may create some drag on growth in the near term. But once we get the all clear and get through the slower growth period, we expect a relatively robust recovery. There aren't tremendous imbalances in the economy, but with perhaps the exception of corporate debt overhang, and there's a lot of what's called pent-up demand, where a lot of households are being forced to save right now, and businesses are not able to produce as much as they'd like because of supply chain disruptions and the like. And so a lot of that will be released going forward. So while the recession is extremely deep relative to past ones, the recovery is relatively quick. You see here we expect in 4 or 5 years to return to the peak, the employment that we had a few months ago. So that's more on the timeline of what we saw in the tech recession rather than the extreme events in the Great Recession and the timber downturn, which took a full 7 years before we returned to our pre-recession level. So, you know, as we discuss, you know, the nature of this recession and recovery, a real important factor, you know, in terms of the long-term severity is really, you know, where has this sudden stop created permanent damage, and what's the role for public policy in alleviating that? And so if we're not going to stop for questions, I'll pass along to Josh to talk about the different avenues for permanent damage, as well as parse this forecast out a little bit across industries and regions of the state.
Madam Chair, this is Greg Smith.
Go ahead, Rep. Smith.
I just wanted to be noted for the record that I'm in attendance.
Terrific. Thank you.
Thank you. Hello.
Thanks, Mark. Chair Haas, Chair Nathanson, members of the committees, for the record, Josh Lehner, economist with the Office of Economic Analysis. And Dan, if we could move to the next slide, please. Thank you. As Mark was saying, one of the key considerations right now when we look at the path of the recovery for the economy is really how much permanent damage are we going to do during the shutdown phase? You know, how many barriers do we need to overcome coming out the other side of the public health crisis to achieve a healthy economy a few years down the road? I mean, along these lines, so there is a lot of things that federal policy in particular is doing to support the economy and to provide a short-term bridge. And I think some of the federal legislation that's been passed, CARES Act in particular, you know, the nature of the legislation is really good in terms of trying to keep heads and firms, you know, heads above water for households and for firms. Now, the question here is one of duration. The CARES package, when it comes to these one-time recovery rebates to households, the expansion of the unemployment insurance benefits, and the PPP loans for small businesses, they're all designed like the economy and the health situation will be okay in July, right? They're a very, very short-term bridge to the other side, but it doesn't look like that's going to be sufficient given that the ongoing problems in public health and the pandemic are going to stretch further than just another. And so all these will be very significant and very helpful to tide us over for the next couple of months and for the past. They're going to be insufficient overall, most likely, and we're going to need more support. Specifically regarding these payments, I think the biggest one to keep in mind would be the issue of firm closures due to the recession and the pandemic, right? It's really, really hard to run a business. You know, 10% of companies go out of business in Oregon every single year, even during good times. That's going to spike during the recession. It's going to spike even further given the sudden nature of the economic shock we have seen and the shock we have seen in recent weeks. So something like PPP loans are great. They're going to help tie these firms over as best they can. However, they last only 8 weeks. So when these 8 weeks are up, what's going to happen to Oregon firms and firms around the country? Are we going to see another round of layoffs that's going to send another shock reverberating through the economy and recovery won't take hold? Or will we see an extension or an augmented program or something? The business side of things is really, really important because it's one thing to see massive dislocations in the labor market, right? Spike in the unemployment rate we saw in yesterday's employment report, and we're expecting it to get worse. It's one thing to see all of these problems in the labor market. It's going to be something entirely if there aren't firms to hire back the workers in, on the other side of the public health. And the relationships and the complex networks that firms build between their workforce and their customers and their suppliers and their intellectual property and all the machines and tools that they have in their to businesses and things like that, right? It takes a really long time to build up that sort of network. So when we break it, it doesn't snap back overnight. And if we have a lot of firms go out of business, we're concerned that banks maybe aren't going to be the most willing to lend new startup activity here in a few months to replace firms that close, given the uncertainty with the virus. And so, you know, if the restaurants go under, you know, financial institutions might not be willing to extend another loan for new restaurants here in a couple of months because we don't have clarity on the public health situation. So firm closures is the probably the biggest risk to permanent damage for the long run in the economy that, that we're really worried about in monitoring as we move. Here in Oregon, if we move to the next slide, please. Here in Oregon, you know, our number one comparative advantage is migration and our ability to attract and retain skilled working age households in particular. And while people move to Oregon in good times and in bad, we know they follow the job. So migration flows into Oregon are significantly stronger during an expansion than they are in a recession. And so the recession today still hit our migration flows, and it actually lowers our long-term population forecast for Oregon as a result. And so that means our economy 5, 10, 20 years down the road is smaller than we previously assumed due to less migration. I think it's important to point out a couple things here when it comes to migration and population. Oregon's still growing, still going to grow faster than the typical state. Who knows, we'll probably pick up that extra congressional seat at federal level and what have you. But here in recent months and in the months ahead, very few people will move through the pandemic. And if these shelter-in-place style policies are in place throughout the summer moving months, you know, migration in 2020 will be next to nothing. People won't move due to the uncertainty of the health situation. Over the medium term, over the next few years, migration will be lower due to the recession. Fewer people will move here given the lack of job opportunities available. Now, longer run, our advisors in our office and our demographer in our office in particular, they all think Oregon's attractiveness will remain intact. It will still be a place of, you know, great scenic beauty. We'll still have lots of job opportunities. Our housing affordability is not going to be good. We know it's bad, but it's not. It's also not the worst along the West Coast. So that's, you know, a silver lining to the bad situation. But overall, Oregon will remain attractive and people will move once the job opportunities become available. So our long-term forecast is down due to the next couple of years being weak for migration. But, you know, the second half of the 2020s, our population forecast is the same as it was prior. So this is a key Oregon-specific permanent damage issue that we move to the next slide. We know that recessions always alter the economy, right? You never come out the other side of a recession looking the exact same as you did prior to the recession, but these changes may be on the margin. But we're expecting there to be some structural differences, some structural damage done to Oregon's economy. The way this chart is comprised, it looks out a handful of years into 2027 and says, what is our current forecast for each step of the economy in Oregon look like compared to what we had 3 months ago? Last talk pre-virus, what did we think the economy would look like a decade down the road? And so the industries near the top of the chart are ones where we see relatively little permanent damage, relatively small, long-term structural changes to these industries, whereas the ones at the bottom are ones we expect to see the most permanent, have lowered our industrial forecast most relative to pre-virus expectations. A couple things jump out. At the top are our large service sector industries that we always expect to lead growth from an employment perspective over the long run for Oregon and for the U.S. professional business services, leisure and hospitality. Now, that one might surprise some people, given that leisure and hospitality is the tip of the spear, right? The initial impact of this recession is really tied to bars and restaurants and nail salons and barbershops and what have you, where the social distancing policies really impacted their ability to perform service. And so while that is the tip of the spear for the recession, we don't think there'll be much long-term damage associated with this. We think, you know, households will go out to eat just as much in 2025 as they did in 2019. They won't this year or next, but when the confidence returns as the health crisis passes, you know, we've seen a decades-long trend where U.S. households now spend as much money on going out to eat as they do on groceries. And so we don't think patterns like that will reverse overnight or persist permanently into the future. And so long run, you know, leisure and hospitality is expected to do just about as good as it was pre-virus, just a path to get to. If we switch to the darker end of the slide, the bottom end, you'll notice we're expecting some persistent damage to last for our goods producers. Natural resources, construction, manufacturing are our goods producing industries, plus brick and mortar retail. These are sectors that never come out of a recession intact. Right? We have never fully regained all of our manufacturing losses at the U.S. Since the early 1980s and in Oregon since the late 1990s. Right? We've never fully regained these, even though, you know, this is a recession that didn't start with a shock. We think there will be some lasting damage here. You can't turn the lights off on some of these manufacturing sectors that have very complex, increasingly international supply chains, and then, you know, put the switch back on and expect everything to be okay. And if that shutdown only lasts a couple weeks or a couple of months, there's likely to be some increase in firm failures and lower startup rates coming out. So we expect the long-run structural changes to keep in mind or the patterns we have seen in recent cycles, where those service sectors come out relatively unscathed, not that they're unscathed, but relatively unscathed, and the goods producers take the largest permanent. I don't think this cycle will necessarily be different this time once we get through the other side of the health.
Excuse me, Josh? Yes. Representative Warner Rushke, did you have a question on this slide?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I do. Josh, good to see you. On this slide, this describes mostly industries. I'm wondering if you can break it down a little bit more as far as what kind of jobs within these industries are likely to be affected. So take, for example, manufacturing. There are managers, there are workers, there's maintenance people. Who in that sector, who in the retail sector have been affected most adversely as opposed to just the industry being affected?
Chair Haas, Representative Reschke, absolutely. The what matters more than the industry itself are those occupations, as you're referring to. Right? And we have certainly seen in the last 20 years what economists refer to as job polarization. What that means is the jobs where the workers are doing routine, repetitive tasks tend to be the ones that are eliminated and automated. That goes for blue-collar occupations like assembly workers on a production line, and also for, you know, some white-collar occupations like administrative and support with computers and the internet and all that sort of stuff. These occupations have seen the largest declines, even while, say, engineers and architects in the manufacturing sector, right? Engineers are at an all-time high within manufacturing, even though those production lines have gone away or been automated by machines to a larger. But we think some of these changes will continue unabated as they typically do during a recession. We know so far this initial hit has really been to lower wage occupations, and particularly the ones impacted by social distancing, so food prep occupations. So, you know, hostesses and waitresses and chefs at restaurants, plus the nail salons and all that sort of stuff have seen the largest impact. But we're also starting to see it with other people that work with their hands due to social construction occupations, production occupations, and the like, plus healthcare, right? The nurses and the doctors with surgeries temporarily. We've seen a lot of initial claims for unemployment insurance coming from the health occupations, both the high-wage ones and the low-wage. And so I think where we'll see the occupational mix change as well. And we can talk more about that in the quarters ahead. Now,
thank you,
Dan. Oh, sorry, Dan. If we could go to the next slide, one thing we wanted to do here is take both this initial shock to the economy, this initial decline that we're seeing, and look around the state. We know not everywhere across the state has been impacted the same. Regional economies within Oregon that have a larger concentration in tourism or travel or leisure and hospitality have been hit the most. So we're talking about the North Coast and in Central Oregon, you know, bubbles there near the top of the chart. Those have been seeing the largest declines here in the last couple of weeks, and we'll do so moving forward until some of these restrictions continue to be lifted and the economy strengthens. However, if we look out into the future, And we take that industry mix and that occupational mix that we're just talking about, and we kind of map that to these local economies, you know, which regions do we expect to see stronger growth or weaker growth just based upon these trends. And you can see here that the urban areas are expected to do better than the rural areas. A lot of this has to do with exposure to office-based work, professional business services, legal, accounting, financial services, and things like that, which are have strongest growth. The regions that have less exposure to these office types of work are expected to grow a little bit slower moving forward. As there's a lot of nuance associated with that. And look at the North Coast, they're impacted considerably today due to the leisure and hospitality shutdown. But moving forward, as we just talked about, we don't expect there to be a lot of permanent damage to leisure and hospitality. So that's not what's going to slow down North Coast. It's the fact that they have relatively little exposure to things like professional services. Conversely, northeastern Oregon, you know, it has a lot of agriculture, a lot of natural resources, a lot of manufacturing relative to other industries. And so that, even though we're expecting there to be more permanent damage associated with that, and so that is one reason we expect northeastern Oregon to grow slower than a lot of other sectors on their end. Now, there's a lot of differences, even county by county within these, specifically when it comes to rural Oregon and Representative Reschke, right? Klamath actually has a relatively strong industrial structure today. Their concentration in professional business services is at least twice that of what rural Oregon overall is. That should be a positive for long-run growth down in South Central Oregon. And so with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Mark to discuss some of the revenue out.
Mr. Smith.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to return back to manufacturing and the impact and the headwinds as it relates to value-added agriculture. I'm looking at the chart, and I'm not seeing where value-added agriculture would fall in there. Are you seeing that? Are you including that under natural resources or under manufacturing?
Chair Haas, Representative Smith, it's going to be a mix, right? If we're talking about the agriculture itself and anything that's done, you know, on the farms or on the facilities on the farms, that's going to be natural resources. Of course, most of that bar for Oregon for natural resources is, you know, I believe, 70 to 80% of that bar is logging. It's not the crops and the dairies and what have you. It's the logging component.
So during the Great Recession of 2009, while many of my counterparts were really, really struggling, in District 57, where we have strong value-added agriculture, we actually saw significant increases in jobs, significant increases and per capita income. And I'm wondering if you could just briefly comment on that, knowing that folks have to continue to eat, and there's certain portions of the state that provide that opportunity.
Absolutely. The Chair Haas, Representative Smith, I think, you know, one thing to keep in mind is, yes, if we're going to dig in beneath manufacturing, you know, food manufacturing outside of some of those closures in the Willamette Valley recently announced, food manufacturing is much, much stronger than we see for food products, metals, machinery, or things along those lines. Food is a non-durable, it's a necessity, so those will see better trends. And to your point about what happened last cycle, right, the price of wheat was quite high. And then, you know, the one point in there was a severe drought in Russia, which impacted, you know, global wheat prices. So that means that Eastern Oregon did relatively better from an agricultural point of view, in part due to higher commodity prices. And that's not the case. Commodity prices are down across the board. And so that will have some feedback through onto, you know, revenues associated with our agricultural industry. Although given the issues in the supply chains and the cases at the slaughterhouses and things like that, we know meat prices, beef prices are going through the roof. That could counterbalance.
That's great insight. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
we'll go back. I'll turn it back over to Mark as we move into the revenue.
Yeah, thanks, Josh. So how to translate this economic forecast into the revenue outlook? As you know, Oregon's underlying economy is much more volatile than that of the typical state, but even more so is its revenue system, where our traditional exposure to personal and corporate income taxes has led to real boom and bust cycles relative to other states. Dan, you can go ahead and go to the first slide in the section. But it's not 100% clear that's going to be the case this time. Given the breadth and depth of the current recession, there's really no state revenue system or mix of revenue instruments that's going to be immune to the pain this time around. And in particular, a lot of this, as Josh refers to it as the tip of the spear, a lot of the pain is consolidated in consumer industries and consumer spending. And insofar as that's the case, this puts sales tax states on more exposed than they are during a typical recession. In most recessions, sales taxes are relatively stable, both in booms and busts, but over the long term have not performed nearly as well as have income taxes, given that spending on big-ticket taxable durable goods has gone down over time as we become more of a service-oriented economy and our consumer households age out of their main spending years. But there is belief that, being an income tax state this time around won't be so bad, and if the fact that the epicenter of the recession is focused on consumer is good for our overall economy. Yes. I'm sorry, someone had a question? Okay, so, not only is the overall economy in Oregon, part of the reason we're more volatile is our exposure to resource industries, manufacturers of goods and the like, which, typically follow a boom-bust cycle. This time, while goods producers are going to get hit, as they always do during a recession, there's a lot of pain being shared among consumer industries, at least on this front end, when the restaurants and bars, leisure and hospitality, and retail are largely shut down. So maybe not so bad this time, and not just sales tax states, but all the other major revenue instruments that states depend on are in trouble as well. You wouldn't want to be a state that depends on hospitality, tourism, or business travel. Likewise, you wouldn't want to be a state that depends on mining or energy revenues right now, given where commodity prices are. So maybe it's not so bad being a personal income tax state. The have to walk back on that a little bit because Oregon is not as much of a personal income tax state as we have been in the past. So even if it is good, maybe not as good as it would have been in the past. Why? Because our revenue system has been evolving to include more and more of sales as the base. Even if we exclude the corporate activity tax that was passed in 2019 and is now coming into effect, we've seen big increases in the importance of a wide range of these revenue instruments, as you see on the right. Lodging taxes, gasoline taxes, vehicle sales privilege taxes, video lottery sales, marijuana taxes. All of these are much more akin to sales taxes than they are income taxes and are accounting for an increasing share of our revenues. So that's where we're going to start in decomposing the revenue forecast. I'm going to pass it back to Josh, who's going to talk about the two biggest of these consumption-driven taxes, which would be the new corporate activity tax and video lottery sales.
Thanks, Mark. Dan, we can go to the next slide, please. Typically, the way our office works when it comes to legislation is we take those initial impacts from legislative revenue office and we fold them into our forecast, and we don't change them until we start seeing real-world data that, you know, contradicts them or makes us change our thinking on them, whether to the positive or to the negative relative to the initial impact. Our plan was that with the cap, we weren't going to touch the cap forecast until we saw tax collections in the filing season in the spring of 2021, just because there's so many uncertainties regarding a new tax, a new tax base, you know, trying to adjust the Oregon size from some of the other state examples that are out there. There's a lot of uncertainty, and we had no data to go on other than all the good work that LRO had put in recent years. One exception was going to be if we saw a recession, that we need to put some impact into the cap forecast to change, you know, to go along with the macroeconomic environment change. So here you can see for the next couple of biennia, actually the whole 10-year forecast horizon, we have reduced cap revenue significantly due to the recession and also due to a little bit of a technicality in terms of there's been some big revisions state GDP in Oregon, and more importantly, some state GDP revisions in Ohio. Ohio revenues, Oregon based, some of these revisions would feed through. And if the revisions would have happened a year earlier than they did, then that might have changed some of those revenue projections as well. And so the chart on the left shows the thinking and the underpinnings for why we're making such revisions at revenue, even though we have hardly any data to date. Household income and household spending in gray relative to our old forecast that's coming from our economic. And you can see that today spending has dropped considerably. We're probably somewhere down in that 20-25% drop in spending today, even though incomes are maybe only down 5-10%. A lot of that has to do with the social distancing and the suppressing of some economic activity, as households cannot spend as much money as they typically do. So we're building savings today in aggregate, because our spending is suppressed relative to our income. But as these social distancing restrictions are unwound or a little bit, and we move into phase one and hopefully phase two and what have you of the economy reopening, we're going to see some of the pent-up demand be unleashed. Consumer spending will increase in the second half of the year. Eventually, it'll go back up to spend with its income. So we have hit cap revenue significantly this biennium, because of the decline in spending. Over the extended forecast horizon, we have lowered cap revenues because we think Oregon's economy will be small. We'll have fewer residents due to that lower levels of migration. We'll have fewer jobs relative to previous expectations, and that translates into less total personal income in Oregon, you know, 5-10 years down the road, and therefore we think less cap revenues than initially 5-10 years down the road as well. So these are big changes. We don't take it, you know, lightly. But given the drastic change in the economic environment, we definitely fed this to our revenue as well. This is part one of our new exposure to spending that we didn't have in the past. And the other one, if we go to the next slide, Dan, would be similar types of impact seen on lottery, right? As bars and restaurants restrict out food only during the strict social distancing phases that we have gone through, Oregon Lottery turned off the video lottery terminal across the state, right? So sales were basically zero, or were zero for a 7-8 week period, which means we see significantly less revenue if we don't have the machines turned on. Now, of course, this isn't necessarily a bad thing, because that $150 million in sales we are expecting means there was closer to $200 million staying in the pockets of Oregonians during this period, where we have all these financial uncertainties and the public health care and pandemic and what have you. But again, it takes into fewer resources now. With one Oregon counties reopening their economy in phase one just a couple days ago, these 30 counties are home to 40% of the state population and 62% of all statewide video lottery sales. And so Oregon Lottery over the weekend turned on the machines in some of these counties. So overall, about half of video lottery retailers were active over the weekend in these counties, and the level of sales they were seeing is about 60% of normal or 60% of expectations. So there's clearly some pent-up demand for gaming and for entertainment options. And so as more counties enter into phase one, as households become more confident in their ability to go out to eat and to play video lottery, we're expecting a nice rebound in growth in the quarters ahead. However, just like we were talking about on the economic side, this rebound in growth will be incomplete. We're not going to go all the way back to pre-virus levels of video lottery sales here for for probably a couple of years due to the ongoing concerns and restrictions when it comes to the social gathering.
Excuse me, Josh. Senator Findley, did you have a question? Senator Findley?
I do. Thank you, Chair Hess. I'd like to go back to slide, if we could, when you talk about your growth coming back in the third quarter. And this slide references the same rebounding that you had on slide four, which is a 38% job growth starting in the third quarter of this year. Is that based on phase two, phase three? What point of restarting Oregon's economy and the phases for the health departments is this based on? Because I think that could be ambitious if we stay in phase two and don't hit phase three until, according to the health direction, there's a vaccine, which could be in the first quarter of the next year. So I'm just curious about what basis do you have for the upward rebound?
Mark, you want to take that one?
Sure. Chair Haas, Representative Findley. These health assumptions are very vital. And while we can't parse down to the details about which counties are in which phase in the forecast, the flavor of the assumption is that, you know, over the summer, we get through the initial phases, phase one, phase two, allowing for most businesses to resume. And then a year from now, for whatever reason, we're really kind of all clear. At that point, you know, with the vaccine, we're through the phases and we have an all clear or something along those lines. So you see here, the snapback in demand is pretty robust, just like the snapback in employment was. But in this case, some of it is, I think, very convincing in terms of spending, because households really have, not the households that have lost their jobs and those that have, which are a lot, and have lost income, but there are a lot of households that haven't lost income, but haven't been able to spend like they normally can. They've been trapped in their houses, and a lot of this demand has really built up, and we expect some of that to be released. As Josh said, boy, it sure looks like it is in terms of video lottery and the demand for gaming. Now, that said, some things won't bounce back to the same extent. The typical example are haircut. I'm dying for a haircut. I'll get one as soon as I'm able here in the Tri-County area, but I won't go get two. And so there won't be as much catch-up. But for a lot of things, I think we can argue that there will be catch-up, both on the firm spending and in household spending. And that's what this really really reflects here, is this period, once we start to open up and eventually get the all clear, we return to where the spending is the same as the income or along the lines of our income trend. So for the next year or so, these things are lifted, we're going to see faster growth in spending than we do in underlying income. But eventually it gets back on track where households are spending what they think they're going to make. But unfortunately, as you see from this graph, that's not where we, you know, thought we were going to be. That there's persistent damage to income, and therefore overall spending will remain low, lower than expected indefinitely. But that said, I think, you know, there will be quite a bit of catch as households get the opportunities to spend that they don't have right now.
Excuse me, Mark. I think when you go get your haircut, you should pay your barber or your stylist twice what you normally would have to bring things back into track. Senator Taylor, did you have a question? Senator Taylor? No? You're on mute? Okay. All right, you guys can continue.
Okay, thank you. So moving past the consumption taxes to the big daddies, which are, you know, personal and corporate income taxes. And for personal income taxes, typically here in the June forecast of an even numbered year, all we would be talking about was the April filing season, doing a postmortem and how did the filings come in relative to what was expected before the filing season began. And that's usually what drives the changes in the forecast. Obviously, this time around, those changes are dwarfed by the economic slowdown. But also, not only are they dwarfed, but we really don't know yet what the full 2019 tax filing season is going to look like. Why? Because the filing deadlines were extended to July 15th. First, the federal government, and then Oregon followed suit. And as a result, a lot of taxes haven't been filed yet, particularly those for filers that are going to owe a bill at the end of the year. Refunds are largely going out the door according to the normal pace, which kind of makes sense. If the state owes you money, a lot of taxpayers do want it right away. Some are delaying, but nevertheless, we have seen most of the refunds come out the door already. Those are on the right-hand side. And it looks like we're going to come in maybe a little south of the forecast, not very much. But anyway, in terms of revenue impact, that would be an upward revision. Fewer refunds out the door means more revenue for the state on net. The payments, however, on the left-hand side, we have seen a clear impact of the filing date. The 2021, typically in those first 3 weeks of April, you see we get the vast majority of our payment processed by the DOR. This year, that didn't happen. We didn't see that big leap, and we're not going to probably see it until we get into maybe the first 3 weeks of July. And now we're thinking that once we do get that burst, those payments will be a bit north of the forecast. So all good news in terms of the still incomplete tax season. But of course, this, again, is overwhelmed by the economic outlook. One thing to mention here is you'll note that the refunds are well below, you know, last year's levels, and the year-end payments are well above last year's levels, and the payments are well below them. What's going on here? That's the payment of our the record kicker credit that are going out right now during the peak tax season. According to the tracking, what we've been following, it looks like as of right this moment today, we're going to cross the $1 billion threshold in terms of kicker payments that have already gone out the door. Well, that's not a happy occasion for our office by any stretch. The timing really couldn't be better, though, in terms of delivering resources to Oregon's household right potentially when they need them most. So maybe a beneficial coincidence there.
All right. Senator Taylor, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Chair Hatt. Sorry, I was having some technical issues, but I'll fix now. I just wanted to get a general sense of I understand we're in unprecedented times and it's really hard to be doing forecasts, but is the basis for some of the assumptions? Is there information coming out from the tax experts around the country saying, use this in your forecast, et cetera? I'm trying to understand, because this is unprecedented, where is the information coming when you're making decisions about what to do about different assumptions? Is that in alignment with how all the other states are doing it? Is it coming from DC? Something, just some context so we understand what you're using for the assumptions, please.
Thank you, Senator Taylor. That's a good question for clarification purposes. So this time we're left a little bit in the lurch in terms of our traditional models because the economic data flow, you know, is lagged. It's going to take quite a while before we see in the data that we use the full impact of this downturn and the shutdown. And so we're left a little bit adrift. Now, that said, we are starting to get some of the real-time data in terms of the severity that we're seeing right now today. And so we have been able to look at the economic side at things like the unemployment insurance claims across industries to get like a sense of how far jobs have dropped. And we just finally got a April employment report yesterday. And so we can look at some of the real-time data and get an idea of how deep this initial spike decline is. But then going forward from that, we really have to depend more on a Delphic process than we normally do. And we had additional meetings with our advisory groups this time around to try to parse out what the most reasonable contours of the recession and recovery were, both from the overall top line and across these individual industries and regions of the state, try to build that up into an outlook. But yes, this is less model driven than it normally is. Now, in terms of nationwide resources, we definitely do consult with our counterparts in other states, and we depend upon U.S. vendors for the U.S. forecast for a lot of these things. Now, unfortunately, the U.S. forecast vendors are drinking out of a fire hose, too. And so as you get down into the nitty-gritty of their forecast, while their top lines tend to look okay, when we get down into some of the stuff that we use and some of the stuff that's important for Oregon, it becomes a lot of that stuff becomes nonsensical. And so our advisors really tried to fix up some of that as well. But yes, this time is more of a Delphic approach, looking at historic business cycles and looking at what we think across different industries, and then working it through our models more to keep everything internally consistent rather than to solve for a solution, if that makes sense. Now, oh, sorry. Did you have a follow-up? No.
A follow-up real quickly, Senator Hass.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. So I'm sorry if I interrupted you. I apologize. So because this is uncharted waters, as we go forward, I just want to encourage that if there's, you know, if we need to change some of these assumptions and we learn that Washington is doing it differently and there, if another state is using an assumption that's getting a more accurate reading of what's happening, et cetera, I'm just nervous about waiting again to the next revenue forecast. And so I just, at least as an individual member, if you find out information or things are changing, at least I would, Senator Hass, and I'm sure I would like to think that other committee members would like to know about those changes. So because we can't really expect our analysts here to have a crystal ball, but things may change and information may come to their knowledge, you know, they may learn things that, you know, we maybe weren't hitting it quite right today, but in June or in July, things may be a little bit different. And I would like to get those updates as they come, if they're appropriate. That would be my request, please. That's all. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Taylor. We're happy to come in front of you guys whenever you'd like.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so moving on to the next slide. Now that we've, you know, the abstracting away from the tracking in the recent tracking season, here's something for Senator Taylor to look at in terms of potential changes down the road of the forecast. Now, I want to add here again with I did a little soliloquy off the top about the nature of our forecast and how we really try to to have it be unbiased insofar as we err, the errors on the upside and downside are equally probable. And there are different risks that we can highlight. And one of the risks here is that different kinds of investment income and business income are going to see a sharper downturn than what we have built in to the forecast today in terms of our most likely scenario. And this is what hits us as an income tax state, is really these volatile investment income tax streams and business income tax streams, and on the corporate profit side of things, these types of income vary wildly, and they can be realized for tax purposes at different times than they were earned in the market. So they can really go away overnight, and we don't really find out a lot of these until the April filing season, when, you know, suddenly businesses and households reconcile their payments and we get these big shifts, right? We're already seeing big drops in a lot of our revenue streams. The withholding out of personal income taxes mostly is coming out of your paychecks, and those as of May went sharply south, as you might expect, and we, you know, we've starting to see, you know, relatively weak estimated payments for the new commercial activity tax. We see gasoline taxes going down, and a wide range of stuff that's already being hit. But going forward, a big concern is going to be the outlook for these volatile income sources, of which I put the biggest example here being realized capital gains. And as you see, we've reduced the realized capital gains forecast significantly as we go out a couple of years, more than $2 billion, a third in terms of the capital gains being pulled off, largely because of the equity market correction. Luckily, as you see here, in March, even before we had the equity market correction, we had some hangover built into capital gains, largely policy and behavior related in terms of responses to the federal tax laws and the like. We were very worried about that because with that dip, if we kept seeing stock market go up, we were going to be looking at a really big kicker. But that's no longer a problem. Now, in fact, it, you know, makes this forecast revision less severe. But is it severe enough? And that's a big question. The nationwide vendors we use for our forecast have a extremely quick recovery, both in the stock markets as well as other business income, profit, all sorts of investment income. And it's really not as bad as we've seen in the past. In terms of the stock market, looking at the Wilshire 5000 or a broad index, both the depth and the duration of this stock market contraction, measured as how long does it take for the stock market to return back to peak, both of those are less than half as long as, both less than half as long and less than half as deep as what we saw during the 2007 recession. And so there is some downside risk here if things change. Now, as of today, this looks fine because we saw in terms of stock market, they went down, a third, something like that overnight during the correction, but have since and have recovered half of those losses. And so we're only down 15-20% on the year where we stand, relative to peak, rather, where we stand today, which is consistent with this IHS forecast, but a little scary, both, like I say, in terms of not looking like what we saw during the tech bust or the housing bust, not nearly as severe. And this is one. Oh,
excuse me, Mark. Rep. Warner Rescue, did you have a question about this?
I had a question just on some of the assumptions. He talked about personal income tax and business income taxes, and I just wanted to understand whether the PPP program and the stimulus checks that were distributed or are being distributed, where do those fit into the assumptions of those two taxes? Are they taxable income? Are they not taxable income? Thank you.
Thanks. For the business side of things, most of it's just excluded from tax. It doesn't show up in terms of the net income calculation. On the personal income tax side of things, things do get a bit complicated with the federal legislation. One being the unemployment insurance, which are, you know, very, very large numbers in terms of this expanded federal program. And in Oregon, unlike most states, we do tax some unemployment insurance benefits over a threshold of $2,400 following the federal definition for income. And so given how much money is out there, that's a pretty big actual boost for Oregon revenues in terms of, you know, a couple hundred million dollars of additional income tax revenue coming from the unemployment check. Obviously, that doesn't fill the whole hole of the wages we're losing, but in terms of its effect, it is a positive. Now, in terms of the broader CARES Act, there's also a positive that comes out of the recovery rebate check, the $1,200 per individual that was sent out. Now, those are not taxable either in the federal level or in Oregon. However, indirectly, they do support Oregon's income tax collection. The recovery rebates are technically given out as a federal tax credit. And so that is lowering your federal tax liability. Well, federal tax liability, you get to subtract off of your Oregon income when you file your taxes. And so if you're paying less federal taxes, you get to subtract less off of your Oregon taxes, and therefore your Oregon tax liability goes up. So, you know, that's LRO has the estimates out for that, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of $100 million, if I am correct. But on net, the overall CARES package is a negative revenue hit, driven by a lot of the other provisions that are in there. There are some smaller provisions that deal with charitable contribution limits. There are provisions dealing with retirement income in terms of IRA distributions and pension funding. But most importantly, there are some business regulations in there or business elements in there that say you can carry back net or operating losses, and you can change your interest deduction, which will lower business income at the federal level, a lot of which we piggyback on in Oregon, which will also lower Oregon taxes. So on net, the CARES Act as a whole is a revenue hit for Oregon, but there are elements of it, particularly the support for households, that boost our revenue. These volatile revenue streams are a source of risk. They always are. And it is one place where there may be some downside risk. So if you see the stock market going back under, that's not going to be good for the next quarterly forecast. But I really want to say, you know, we get this question, you know, every time that, okay, well, what do you expect the forecast to show next time? And the answer to that is always the same, that this is our best guess, what we're showing you now. Our expectation is that this is going to be exactly the same 3 months from now. And we know it isn't, but that's our best guess for what it's going to look like 3 months from now. And I understand the sensitivity, given that, you know, our office's record of coming in with the bad news and trickling it out over a long period of time that says, oh, here we go again. Once we get one bad forecast, we're going to get several more in a row. But we are doing our best to avoid that this time, and given the sudden nature of the recession, we might do a better job than our office has in the past. So finally, I guess moving on to the bottom line, which is the next chart, which is how much money is available for the state, or how much has the revenue forecast changed over time. And you see here quite significantly. Now, I know we have some new members here, so I need to explain what these numbers are, because there is always a lot of confusion here, and I'm often remiss at explaining. So what these show, and of course we didn't label it well on the chart for everyone, which makes it even more confusing, but these are the changes relative to the March forecast. So how much has our expected collections over each of these given biennium changed, biennia changed relative to the March forecast? So when you see out there in 23-25, you know, negatives for personal income tax, corporate income tax, and the like, that doesn't mean that the economy is still contracting and that the revenues are still falling a few years from now. That's not the case. In fact, just like employment, somewhere around 2024-2025, we expect revenues to return to our pre-recession peak, to where they were before the shutdown. But that said, they're not going to return all the way to where we thought they would be back in March. In March, we expected the economy and revenues to continue to grow. So even though we may be all the way back to where we were, we're not back to where the forecast expected us to be 2 years from now. We haven't dug all the way out of that hole, so there is some lasting damage reflected here. So what are the numbers all told? Here you see for the current biennium, for general fund only, we're looking at a reduction of $1.9 billion, the vast majority of which would be personal income tax revenue. And then we have, now we have other big, large revenue items that also typically are fairly flexible for state policymakers too, and so kind of belong in the general fund conversation, which are the lottery and the corporate activity tax. Marijuana taxes don't really fit that bill. Really, all of that revenue is dedicated to different sources, but a lot of the lottery and corporate activity tax revenue is technically fungible for policymakers. So we add that as well, given that they're increasing size. And so including those items, another $769 million in reductions for the current biennium. So added together, that's a $2.7 billion decline in the current biennium in terms of the revenues that were expected to come in the door. As we go out to future years, you see those numbers change. The biggest change as we go to the next biennium is the fact that we now have a recession in the forecast for the entire biennium in terms of 1921. We're getting towards the halfway point already. We already have one April set in the door, and so the impact for the whole biennium are scaled down, given that we already have started it. But as we go forward, those revisions are very significant. They compound to $4.4 billion here in 21-23. $3.4 billion reduction in 23-25, and as we go into the out years, 25-27 is at $2.5 billion, and 27-29 at $2.1 billion below. So a very significant revenue hit that you know, goes across broadly across the vast majority of our revenue instruments. Not very many are looking good. See, the marijuana tax in the near term is certainly doing well. We're tracking very high on marijuana sales so far this year, and particularly in April and since the shutdown was instituted. But even those taxes aren't immune to the downturn, as you see as we go out into outer biennium. Once those household income losses kick in, it does affect our sales outlook for everything, including cannabis.
Excuse me, Mark. I do have a couple of questions. Let's start with Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I see we're looking at $2.7 billion less than we expected. Is that correct, Mark?
That's correct. For the current biennium, $2.7 billion less than what we told you in March.
And what was our kicker?
Our kicker was $1.7 billion. $1 billion of it is having already gone out the door.
The rest will, of course, continue to go out the door.
That's right. Now, as we get to that July 15th filing deadline, we see a lot of the payments that would be affected by the kicker, particularly a lot of high-income households that are going to owe Oregon tax at the end of the year. They will owe less as a result of the kicker, and like I say, another another $700 million yet to go out. Most of that will go out in the current biennium, and then some trickles down until the end of time as people revise and amend and refile. You know, those numbers continue indefinitely, but the vast majority of it will go out by the end of this filing period.
Thank you.
Rep. Owens, did you have a question?
Yes, Chair. Thank you. Mark, I appreciate this, and these, of course, are big numbers, but I think it's tough for me and sometimes my constituents when we throw a number out there to understand the impact of that number. Is there any way we can do the personal income tax and all the corporate income tax and lottery and a percent also? So, I mean, just because personal income tax is down $1.58 billion, I'd also like to know what percent that is down.
Thanks. That's a good point, and that is available in our report in all our revenue tables. We do, of course, levels and percentages. But for most across the board, most of these revenue items, we're talking about 20 to 25% hit right up front, with some of them being a little more severe, particularly the corporate activity tax and the lottery revenues, which are tied to the spending and the shutdown, are the most severe. Those are in your 25% range. And then most of the others, like the incomes and the like, are more in the 20% range along the lines of what we're seeing in the labor market. So, yeah, so that actually, Representative Owens, that transitions fairly well into our next slide, which is our last. I'm sorry for going over time. But in terms of the, you know, the budgetary implications, we need to also mention what these revenue changes. There are really three pieces, and we have two of them here for you today. One is the revenue changes in terms of what we expect. The second is what you see here. What kind of budgetary cushion do we have available to us to you know, soften the blow? And then the last part is left for the budget folks, the budget experts, which would be, well, how much do the need for spending on state programs go up? Because that'll widen this budget gap as well as the revenue side. But as you see here, the story for reserves is unequivocally a good one. For our two, one statutory and one constitutional reserve funds, the Education Stability Fund, which gets direct deposits out of lottery sales, and the Rainy Day Fund, which gets direct deposits out of corporate minimum taxes as well as ending balances at the end of a biennium, after 10 years of recovery, these deposits have really added up, where we're now looking, as of today, at $1.6 billion in these two combined, which is 8% of a two-year budget period. So a very, you know, very significant cushion. And that's not where it ends. You see here from our chart, we have the gray bar that we had of a huge ending balance at the end of the last biennium has gone away. Unfortunately, our forecast today was so big that it nuked that, but it's not going to go away in terms of that softening the blow. We had, as you see, we had over $1 billion in balances in addition to our dedicated reserve fund. And part of that was because of the way the short session ended without, you know, allocating a lot of these balances. They're sitting on the table when this thing occurred. And so, you know, that first over $1 billion of a hit has, you know, in terms of the budget implications, has been absorbed by the ending balance and now, or the balances, and then we still have access to these reserves should policymakers choose to dip into them. So this will be a significant cushion that we haven't had in the past to try to really offset this historic revenue decline. Our office has never put out a forecast with this kind of a delta before. This is truly unprecedented. So with that, you can go to the last slide because that's it for our prepared materials. But if the chair still says there's time, happy to entertain any more questions you might have.
Yes, Mark McMullen, Josh Lerner, thank you. We do have some questions. Let me start. We've been familiar with this alphabet of U recovery, V recovery, and I think today you introduced us to the square root recovery, which I like. You did not touch on, though, the W recovery. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that and how specifically it might relate to Oregon, if it's a possibility down the road, how likely, how unlikely.
Oh, thank you, Senator Haas. Dan, if you go back up to the square root chart, it might help the discussion here. So first, in terms of, you know, this, the nature of the recession and recovery and, you know, letters and the like, the Fed Reserve chairman has made a funny comment last week about saying that economists are way too obsessed with letter names and trying to label this stupid thing with a letter shape, which unfortunately we're very guilty of in our offices, as well as the consensus in terms of economic forecasters, trying to talk about whether it's a V or a U or a bathtub shape or square root in this case, which I think we coined, but I've seen elsewhere at this point. Now, the Federal Reserve Chairman, that said, describes an outlook that, you know, sounds exactly like this square root shape that we're seeing here, just not summarizing it into a label. But I really like your next question about the potential W shape. And in our document, you'll see that we've included alternative scenario. And the downside alternative scenario looks like a W. Really, what happens in terms of this inflection point, the uncertainty, is in that slower growth period. Okay, once we've had our whatever bounce back there will be, once we've opened up and allowed business to continue in these industries, what happens going forth from there? And this is where our advisors had a lot of uncertainty and a lot of concern. In the baseline, we have a real flat growth, not much going on for a couple years, and that's consistent with the other recessions and recoveries you see as well, where it took a while recently for the, you know, for the growth to get started in 07 and 01 and the like. But there are other very plausible scenarios, one of which being the W, which I, like I say, is in our outlook. And what the W would mean is, okay, we open things back up, but then things worsen again in the fall and winter months. Of course, one plausible reason for that would be, well, what if the, you know, infection rates blow up again and we have to turn back on some of this social distancing, or people become afraid and they don't reengage because of the, you know, the virus count. And that's one bit. But there's other risks there as well, you know, not the least of which being the public policy environment. The federal government set up the PPP and small business loan program as if everything's going to be hunky-dory in July, and firms can then go ahead and hire back their workers and get their loans forgiven and or start making debt payments at that point. But we really don't know what that sales environment is going to look like in July. And for leisure and hospitality, firms might be well south of where it was before, and it's possible that business doesn't pencil out and that we're going to see a new wave of business closures and the like at that point. And of course, on the household side, that's when the big federal expanded unemployment insurance is supposed to expire as well. So that's a real sketchy point as we get to the end of this biennium, the beginning of the next biennium, where we go. And that W double dip scenario is a very likely one, and that's what we've incorporated into our revenue forecast. So for the 21-23 biennium, if we go into that double dip scenario, you're looking at, you know, another $1.5 billion off the revenue outlook if that were to occur. It's also possible that we're going to get stronger growth. We do have an upside scenario as well. You know, what happens if the vaccine is developed a lot sooner than we think? or, you know, confidence returns much quicker than we think. Well, we might be able to, you know, forego some of this slower growth period and transition right into that mature expansion cycle you see there, in which case things would be a little better. In that case, we're looking at over the for the next budget period, around $500 million in additional revenue. So those are some of the alternative scenarios. Unfortunately, for budgeting purposes, boy, we have to pick one number, and so this red line is it.
Thank you, Mark. We do have a couple of questions here before we wrap up. Rep. Nathanson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have three questions. It's fine if you want to answer them very briefly, and we can follow up later. The first relates to your describing to us at the very beginning of your presentation that the health forecast is a key component of the economic forecast. And you have talked about that even just a minute ago. I have heard some economic analysis that opening too soon, or if social distancing measures aren't kept up to the same degree that they have been, Oregonians have been doing great so far, but in their enthusiasm to get back to normal rather than resume activity under a new normal, which is requiring still some safety measures, such as masks and social distancing. What happens if it turns out that if things don't work out quite as well? What does this do to consumer confidence? And is this factored into, you know, potential W's, or what happens if there's some poor result over this phase one? Does that just lengthen the time to recover, or does it do another hit for permanent damage to the economy? Then my other two questions are briefer. One, could you tell us, please, about the potential benefit from investing in infrastructure? We know that when we do, for example, we do bonding to build things or repair things, that helps put people to work. It also builds permanent lasting things of value for Oregons to use. Is there a potential benefit from investing in infrastructure at this time? And then the third question is, does the growing national deficit have any impact on your forecast? Is that factored in anywhere? Thank you.
Sure, Chair Nathanson, I'll take them in order. And as you say, the health forecast is absolutely key. And I think you characterized it very well in terms of, okay, here a few months from now, as we get towards the end of the year, the confidence of households and firms to stick their neck out and go back to normal is going to make all the difference. And obviously that confidence is intricately tied to what's happening in terms of infection rates and the like. And so I really fear sometimes it's kind of listed as a false trade-off between the health situation and the economic growth, when it's really not, insofar as, oh, well, you know, if we, you know, go ahead and sacrifice some lives and open up the economy, well, then we'll do better as an economy versus, you know, if we continue to have draconian measures and save lives, well, then the economy will be worse off. When it's really not like that, because really these two things are symbiotic, because this economic growth is really based on how the disease is going and how consumers and firms feel confident about that and to what extent they're ready to return to normal. And so really a return to normal in the health outlook is vital for this economic outlook. And so I think the two are tied really together. So, and very tightly. And I think that you know, and that'll continue to be the case going forward. So, yes, I think you characterized that very well. In terms of, well, what happens if, you know, we do go into a double dip and the permanent damage you suggested on your question, that's bad. Insofar as the longer this recession lasts and the longer we go without income and with, you know, firms having to struggle for cash flow and households having to struggle to pay bills, the more of them are going to go under, which means more permanent damage long term. And so from a policy perspective from the state, anything we can do to help our disadvantaged households and the ones that are at the most risk of going under and the small businesses that have the most trouble with cash flow, if we can just get them through these few months, however long that is, obviously the longer the harder, the less permanent damage there will be going forward. So that's very important. In terms of investing into infrastructure, I feel very strongly that right now is you know, pencils out as a very good time for states to make these kind of investments. Now, states, for their general funds, and most states, you know, a lot of state spending, you know, across 49 states have constitutional requirements where we have to balance budgets within a 1 or 2 year budget period. But when we're talking about infrastructure investments or other kinds of investments that have really huge upfront costs and expected to have benefits over a long, you know, period, those don't fit into these 1 or 2 year budget cycle. And so we depend on capital accounts and the like. And so when does one of these capital projects or investment projects pan out? Well, it's when those borrowing costs are offset by these returns on the investment, of which, you know, you can think of several. And you mentioned infrastructure projects, which, you know, traditionally do have a big return on investment, you know, in terms of, you know, a bridge over the Columbia River or transit or the like. But there are other investments as well, you know, in terms of you could think about rural broadband, given the changing economy. You could think about early childhood investment. Also, but whatever your favorite public investment is right now, almost canceled out in the current environment because state costs are so incredibly low right now for state. And as long as investors, which seems they're still confident, as long as investors feel that Oregon's a good bet and that Oregon will continue to pay its bills, we can borrow at darn near zero rates right now. So almost anything pencils out at these rates. And so investing in infrastructure, now is the time, you know, in terms of both the need and the cost of providing some of these investments that people have wanted in Oregon for quite some time. Finally, national deficit. The national deficit really works into our forecast through the U.S. outlook, and it works through it in a couple of ways. One is in the near term, deficits are good for, you know, just like at household level, if you start spending a lot out of your credit card, you can have a pretty fun month or whatnot. And so the same thing happens at the federal level. As you increase these deficits, unequivocally passes into growth. Now, some ways of increasing the deficit increase growth more than others, particularly getting money in the hands of the households and firms that most need it and will inject it directly into the economy. That's always the best. But nevertheless, term, if you're going to run up the credit card, that's going to help outcomes in the near term. The issue with deficits is more of a medium and long-term problem, which as you build up the debt burden in an economy, that's going to increase your borrowing costs indefinitely. And so then anytime you need to support an investment or the like, it's going to cost you more and more over time. And the debt service chunk takes a bigger and bigger chunk out of public budgets. And so over time, having a big debt overhang is an economic negative. In the near term, deficits are like a sugar high.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Rep. Owens, did you have a question? Are you okay?
Yes, thank you, Chair Hass. It was more just for Josh after a clarifying conversation that he had after Representative Smith asked about value agriculture. And we were talking about the impacts of agriculture long-term and that sector recovery. And the comment that Josh made, I have to talk about is, he said that the increase in beef prices might offset some of that loss to our ag producers. The only groups that are seeing the income generated from beef are the packers. Our ranchers, our beef producers right now are scheduled to be 40 to 50% less on the sale of their cows in the state of Oregon. A lot of them are going to go under. The beef prices that you see in the market do not go to our producers. There are some policy changes that we can make in the state to allow value added in beef, but we haven't got to them yet. But I just want to tell Josh that those prices in the market are not going to have any effect to our ag producers in Oregon.
Representative Owens, thank you for passing that along. I did not realize that. I know that absolutely right. Where the increase in prices flow to along the supply chain is always different given the market circumstances. Like, for instance, you know, the one we hear a lot is here in Oregon, when we see higher log prices, those benefits flow to the landowners, and the log supply is the issue in the wood products industry. Whereas in the South, when you have high log prices, those flow to the mills, not the landowners. So pointing out that it's the packers and not the ranchers is something that's very important, so I appreciate it.
From what I understand, we're seeing the same thing in terms of the market for eggs. High prices are getting, you know, absorbed by the middleman.
Eggs, quite a few of them. So thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. Representative Laura Spence.
Thank you, Chair Haas. I have two questions. The first is very straightforward. The other one has a bit more complexity to it. The first is about, you know, we talk a lot about the fact that this is a balancing between a public health crisis and an economic crisis, right? So I would like to know, to what extent did you work with OHA or any other health agencies to come up with your projections and to use their data to confer as to how we will be able to move forward? Just to illustrate for our constituents how you guys work together and what that looks like. And then the second question is, we talk a lot about a return to normal, but we know for communities of color and for some of our most vulnerable community members that a return to normal is really a position of inequity and mass structural and institutional disparities. And so when we talk about earlier, I think, Josh, you talked about a five-year uptick for our economy to return to pre-COVID levels. What does that look like for communities of color? And I think it also has an implication for my first question, whereas you look at how COVID-19 is impacting communities of color at a disproportionate rate than their non-minority counterparts, how are you taking into context that data as well as looking at what it will take for communities of color to be able to be at a basis that really illustrates economic viability?
Thanks, Josh. You want me to take the first one, and then I'll pass to you for the second part?
Sounds good. Thank you.
So for the collaboration with OHA, obviously the health situation dictates everything, and I think you put it very well, Representative Spence, talking about, well, you know, these things are really two hand in hand. There's not a trade-off. Like I said, I think that's a false trade-off to say between economic growth and the health situation, but they're, you know, they're very much entwined and are going to, you know, react together. So that said, you know, when we talk about these alternative scenarios out there, those are really based in terms of their timing a lot on these epidemiological models. When do we expect either things to go back south in terms of the fall and the winter months? Are we going to get increases in infection levels and a step back? Or when are we going to expect things to get better, when a potential treatment or vaccines can kick in? And so those really, that epidemiological outlook really impacts this shape of the near-term outcome. But we also work with OHA on some of the near-term timing stuff. You know, we were grasping at straws for every sort of indicator that's already showing this decline in it. So we can look at traffic counts from ODOT and look at, you know, all sorts of things. But with OHA, they have some leading indicators which do highlight the severity of the decline, in particular the SNAP payments or the food stamp, the traditional food stamp program. And that both at a regional level and overall the state really does confirm what our thoughts, both that the severity of the damage is deep and that it's disproportionately affecting rural areas and inner city communities of color and the like. So with that, I'll go ahead and pass to Josh to answer the second part.
Thanks, Representative. I think the question you arise about who will be impacted the most and how will we look in the years to come and once we get to a healthy economy is very apt, and it's one that we plan on discussing more in the quarters ahead because, right now we're focusing on the big picture macro trends, but we know this will play out differently in different regions of the state and for different populations. The one thing we have learned, or at least one thing that economists and federal policymakers have taken to heart, or at least it seems they've taken to heart a whole lot more this cycle than in previous, is the fact that the benefits of a strong economy don't accrue equally. To your point, whether we're talking about urban-rural disparities, we're talking about disparities between college graduates and non-graduates, whether we're talking about between, the white population, the Hispanic population, our African-American population, and the like, the benefits of a strong economy kind of accrue at different points, and it was only in, say, the last 2 to 3 years where we really started to see strong economic gains accrue equally and start, we reached what looked like a historically low poverty gap between Oregon's white non-Hispanic population and communities of color. Still big racial gap. We still have the smallest racial gap we'd ever seen in the 2018 data, right? And that was after 10 years of economic recovery. And so now with the recession, we're going to undo some of it, whether it's employment for people without a college degree or whether it's people in rural communities or communities of color. We know a lot of these gains will be undone and might take longer to recover than they would if we look at those offline trends. So this is something that's absolutely important, and it's something we will, talk more about this certainly in the quarters.
And if I may, I think this really does open up a potential avenue for state policy. We know from the unemployment insurance claims that not only has the health situation impacted community colors disproportionately, but so too has the layoff and the economic damage have also disproportionately affected communities of color. And so, again, in terms of this long-term outlook, how are different communities and different industries and like going to come out of this? A lot of it has to do with the amount of permanent damage that's done and places that have to shut down or households that go under during the recession. And that's part one of the anecdotally one of the big weaknesses in the PPP in the federal program is that it was a first come first serve situation, and so firms with an existing lending relationship with a bank, were ready to go and got it right away. But others who didn't have a traditional lending relationship, it took more time, and some of them didn't get to the queue. That's also true of nonprofits. Of which, didn't have a really good defined ownership structure, and so they didn't fit into the Small Business Association's framework easily. And so those got left out, particularly in the first round. And so all of these, these loan programs are really to try to keep firms afloat during this cash flow issue. And to the extent that communities of color, and as well as our rural communities, didn't get to participate in these as much. That's a risk going forward, and like I say, a potential avenue for state policy.
Thank you,
Representative Marsh. Did you have a question?
Thank you, Chair Hass. Yes, I do. I'm going to push my luck and also try and sneak in two questions, recognizing that you may want to respond offline. The first one, a few minutes ago, you referred to rural broadband and infrastructure investments. I want to drill down into that just a little bit. Clearly, the stay-at-home orders changed the way we do business, spurred telehealth, spurred online education, spurred online meetings. And it also identified a huge digital divide that exists, lots and lots of broadband infrastructure gaps. So my question is, I'm wondering if you just have any reflections or comments on the role of broadband investment in recovery efforts to come over the next year or two or four. And the second question is, to a limited degree, the state has perhaps the opportunity to provide some financial support to areas of the state that have been most damaged during this experience. And I'm wondering if there are certain indicators that we should be looking at to try to understand what regions, what counties have been most hard hit. Are those unemployment rates? Are there other economic indicators that would really tell us the story of the overall impact of the pandemic? So thank you.
Okay, second half first. Eventually, we'll get some good numbers, census data and the like, to get a better idea of the regional mapping of the pain. So right now, we're left with not as many indicators as we would like, given that this is rapidly evolving. But we do have some, which have do reflect on a regional basis, the largest of which are these unemployment insurance claims, which we know how those are distributed across the state. Not surprisingly, areas with a big leisure and hospitality and hospitality industries have been hit the hardest right up front. And some of the areas with different industrial structures, more exposure to professional services and goods production have done better. And as Josh said, not just all of the ones you'd think of right off the bat, but places like Klamath Falls and Roseburg as well have benefited from being less exposed to the industries that are directly hit, or what Josh says, tip of the spear of the distancing. So we will know a lot more as this thing unfolds, but right now we're using some of our, the leading indicators that we have at a rural level. We have things at a regional level, things like bankruptcy rates, and like I say, the food stamps, the unemployment insurance benefits, and the like, what we've seen, housing permits, all the stuff that we can get at closer to real time at a regional level. We're milking those for all they're worth, but we will get more as we go forward in terms of that. In terms of the role of broadband investment, this is a big, when we have discussions both with our advisory groups and with the governor's task force, comes up again and again as, okay, well, what is going to be permanently different? What should we think about going forward in terms of structural changes, or how will we emerge from this differently than we have in the past? And one of the things that Josh talked about in the migration section was, well, what about less urbanization? Or what about people, not wanting to live in dense areas and the like? And like you said, in terms of also expanding ability of firms to have remote workforces, or maybe deciding they need less office space or less business travel and doing more things electronically, well, all of those things would point towards more return on investment for these broadband investment. I don't have a favorite in terms of picking across investments. It's really hard to say whether dredging a deep water port or building a Columbia River crossing or broadband, rural broadband or early childhood education. I don't have a dog in the fight in terms of which one you think is going to have the best return on investment. I think rural broadband arguably will have a good one. And like I said before, across the board, I think any of them right now are going to return far above what the borrowing cost to fund them would be.
I had two quick points I wanted to make, and that is all of Oregon does relatively well for the work from home potential and the actual share of workers working from home, whether you're talking about Portland, certainly Bend is a national leader, Medford, Eugene, Coos Bay, all the places. Data shows that we have a larger share of work from home, probably in large part due to some of our that shrink kind of further in the decade ahead, probably. And so an investment in better internet and rural broadband certainly will go a long dividend. other thing I would point out about where we're going to share funds or talk about economic damage, something to keep in mind that we see every recession, or something that should come up every recession, is, you know, some of the importance of anchor employers from some of our smaller regional economies. Right now, certainly leisure and hospitality is taking the brunt of this upfront hit. But should some of those larger anchor employers in some of our smaller communities go under due to cash flow issues, or, you know, where this liquidity problem becomes a solvency problem as the duration of the recession passes, that will have longer ramifications. And so monitoring that and working with some of those employers will be highly important. As, again, as we've seen, certainly in our timber community, when the mill shuts down, you know, what does the next 40 years look like? A lot of places that hasn't.
All right. Representative Alyssa Kenny-Geyer, did you have a question?
Yeah, I did. Thank you so much, Chair. Mark, you touched on this a couple times about the need to invest in some of these infrastructure, broadband. You mentioned early childhood. I'm wondering, in terms of public services in general, early childhood, child care, we know that once child care closes down, it's very hard to open up. And most child care on a national survey, if they are closed for more than a few weeks, their chance of reopening is very low. So that clearly has an impact on them, as well as the workers who want to send their kids to child care and get back to work. So I'm just thinking about, have you done kind of a sector analysis in terms of investing versus slashing public services, rent gap assistance, early childhood, child care, education, foster care, mental health services, what the impact would be? You know, clearly we're hoping for a big federal stimulus here to cover some of those specifically. But if not, we're looking at a fairly robust reserve, and we're trying to decide how much in public sector services we should invest in that. So I'm wondering if you're doing an analysis of what the impact would be if we slash those services, the impact on the economy, particularly on vulnerable populations, versus if we are able to invest to the extent we don't get as much federal stimulus as we'd like, dipping into our own reserves rather than some of the agency cuts that agencies have had to prepare recently.
Yeah, Representative Kenny-Geyer, Chair Haas. Unfortunately, we haven't done a detailed analysis of the trade-offs there or the relative importance there, but I can say that in summarizing what I've said today, there are really two ways that policymakers can help, you know, in terms of this longer-term economic trajectory and the well-being of the state. And the first is to address, you know, folks that are going to go under now and the permanent damage that's caused in the near term. And that really speaks to a lot of the services that are provided that you mentioned, that, you know, if we, you know, the extent to which we can provide state services today, we'll keep households and businesses afloat so that they can get through these terrible months and hopefully land on their feet. If they don't land on their feet, then the pain is extended over time. So there's definitely a role for public policy in terms of supporting near-term programs and minimizing the permanent damage. And then there's also a role for public policy by saying, oh, okay, well, given this cost situation, we can invest in some of these projects that we expect to have a big returns over the extended horizon. So those are two real issues, but in terms of weighing them against each other, you know, we haven't made those calculations, and frankly, really kind of want to stay out of the policy realm given you know, our prime directive here is the forecast. But about the child care, that is intimately important. Both our advisory groups as well as the governor's task force spent a lot of time with this. This was very difficult in terms of setting up the phases and the reopening, because in terms of social distancing, child care is one that is really, really hard to, you know, follow any good social distancing protocols. But at the same time, you can't send parents back to work if they have nowhere to put their kids. And so, you know, that was a tricky one in terms of childcare and day, you know, and camps and the like, in terms of when are we going to allow them to open. From the social distancing perspective, probably shouldn't, but in terms of the, you know, reality, we need to in order to send folks to work. Now, the unique nature of this one, hopefully the hit won't be as hard on childcare as you described, that when childcare centers go out of business, they rarely come back. Because what happens if you shut down for a couple months, your clients are forced to find somewhere else to put their kids. And when you open back up, they might not necessarily pull them out of the new place to bring them back to your place. In this situation, all of the childcare centers were closed at once. And so maybe there's some hope that, you know, folks will bring their kids back to the place they left in higher rates than they do in a normal situation.
Thank you.
Okay. Mark and Josh, thank you for a very sobering and illuminating presentation. Mark, please don't forget to pay twice for your haircuts the next time you go in. Committee members, I miss seeing you in hearing room A. I think this is a time where we need to breathe. Remember that old line, tough times never last, but tough people do. So, Rep. Mathenson, I'll go first. The Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue is adjourned.
The House Interim Committee on Revenue is adjourned.
Goodbye, everyone.